listeners, you are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. On the show, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today we are super stoked to have David Hansel on our show. David is a Minneapolis-based director, puppeteer, and teaching artist. David Hansel, welcome to Beckett's Babies.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh my gosh, we're so excited to talk to you. We met David at the University of Iowa 10 years ago, 11 years ago.
10 years ago. I my last year was 2012, 2013, and that was, I think, your first year for both of you.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
So speaking of memories, we like to start off every interview by asking our guest about their earliest memory. So what is the first thing you remember?
I was like, oh no. But this is fine. I have a very clear memory that I've worked out in journaling and in therapy that I can briefly talk about. I was doing a lot of journaling during the pandemic. So my first memory, it would have been before I was 3 years old, because my sister was born 2 weeks before I turned three. Okay. And so when I was younger, so I must have been maybe 2 years old, 2.5, somewhere, maybe even younger than two, but somewhere in that ballpark, I had this like beautiful, like strawberry blonde, curly hair, almost in like a Shirley Temple ringlet, like not that pristine, but that kind of general idea.
Aww.
And so when I was in public, I was also very, very quiet and very, very shy. So when I was in public with my mom, you know, strangers would say like, you have such a beautiful daughter. And my mom would be like, oh, you know, that's okay. But my child is actually a boy and his name is David. And then, you know, and that happened enough that I remember that sort of recurring. And then there was a time a little bit later, I was in an elevator and I think I was being held because, you know, you have to get into the elevator fast. I was with both of my parents. And this woman said to my, the stranger said to my mom, like, oh, you're such a beautiful daughter. And then my mom just kind of laughed it off and she was kind of uncomfortable. And then we walked out of the elevator and my father said, we're cutting off all of his hair tomorrow. And so the next day, my grandma cut off all my hair and it never grew back like that. But my mom saved one ringlet in a little Ziploc that's stapled in the back of my baby book. So I have this artifact of that time. And I remember the haircut and like the elevator, like, and the moments before. And that's sort of the most distinct, specific earliest memory.
And did you feel really attached to your hair? Like, how did you feel about having it cut off?
I think my memories of like that part of my life are so, I was so much living sort of in my own head and I wasn't, I was sort of afraid of so many things. Mm-hmm. Or just like, I felt like I was sometimes like walking on eggshells. So like, I don't feel like any sort of attachment, but it did feel like this, like part of myself, even at that age was like, was wrong or like had to be stripped away or disguised or removed.
Wow, that's a really powerful story.
I guess this is how we're starting our conversation today. But.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. And then how did you go from that two-year-old to getting into theater?
Well, my mom, I think, had bought season tickets to the Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis. Okay. And I really liked it. I grew up in Shoreview, so that's a northern suburb outside of St. Paul.
Okay.
So it's about a half hour outside of the cities. So we, she got season tickets when I was probably three. I think I saw my first show there, and then I think we got season tickets the next year when I was four. And I really liked it, so I think she just decided that's where we would spend our money or like spend our time because I just it resonated with me so much. Mm-hmm. And then I think I saw my one of my really good friends was in like a summer musical when he was eight. And I didn't even know like kids could do that. And so then the next year when I was 9, the summer before fourth grade, or maybe I was 10, I'm not sure, but it was the summer before fourth grade. I think I had asked my mom if I could be in a play. And I was very afraid to like ask to be in a play. And then even more afraid to like quote unquote audition, even though it was like a pay to play. I was like terrified, but that sort of was my gateway into that.
Cool. And then did you study theater in undergrad, or how did you keep kind of pursuing that?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I continue to do like community and civic theater maybe once a year, twice a year as I grew up. And then we didn't really have much of a theater program in my high school. So I would say like even in hindsight, I was doing a lot of different things. I was like dabbling in a number of different things in high school, but I wasn't really extraordinary at anything. So then when I went to college, I went to Lawrence University, which is a very small liberal arts college in Appleton, Wisconsin. It's about 1,400 students. And it's very like hippy dippy, woo woo, like crunchy granola, artsy fartsy. Like there's a music conservatory attached to like 1 in 3 students is studying music or something like that. So it was like, and like there was a lot of like class sizes were like 10 students or less.
Wow.
And there were a lot of like independent studies and like student driven projects. So I was studying theater and English and studio art. I was trying to triple major in 4 years, but I ended up doing, I couldn't do that. So, and I had to be done in 4 years because that's when the money would run out. So I did, I think English and theater, and then I had a minor. I almost majored in studio art, but I think it was just a minor when I left, when I finished. And when I was in undergrad, again, I was never someone who was extraordinary at anything. I just really loved theater. So I was acting and stage managing and working in painting sets and working in the costume shop and running the light board. And I think I also, then I started directing as well near the end. And so I fell into directing sort of near the end of undergrad, I guess you could say. But I was also like kind of jack of all trades, master of none, and really still am.
That's so interesting to hear, because I can definitely see like the studio art influence in your work. You've always struck me as someone who's really good at just making things, and whereas I know a lot of theater people, including myself, who can kind of imagine stuff, you are really good at actually making things tangible. Did you, when you were doing that studio art minor, did you do like sculpture at all?
No, I actually never took a sculpture class. It was the one class I never took while I was at school. My experience in the studio art program was that the art students really didn't like me.
Why?
And that, like, I kept putting, I think in their mind, I was putting too much like narrative into my paintings.
So interesting.
And I would have like dialogue. Like dialogue bubbles, or like I got really into doing like underground comics or like zines and graphic novels. So my final project, it was kind of a disaster, but I did do I don't think I had enough time to like execute it fully, but I did do like a self-published graphic novel as my
final
project.
That's so cool.
Wow.
What was it about?
It was called Arty Farty Faggy Party.
That's an amazing title.
And it was about, I mean, it was very, I had this autobiographical character that had I had been putting into these different art projects called Bradley Pinkbottom. So it was about this like severely depressed, like queer artist having an existential crisis, who was sort of like falling in and out of these like sort of doomed romances, and is going to this Halloween party that his sister is hosting in New York City. And she was like a business person who didn't understand him. And she was like trying to hook him up with this professor, English professor. And he was like rolling his eyes about it. And then I think at the end of the party, he like jumps off the building and commits suicide.
Oh my God.
But it was charming. I mean, it wasn't all like Sturm and Drang and depressing.
Wow.
There was a whimsy about it, I promise.
Wow.
This is a really dark conversation.
There is something, I feel like making a graphic novel and directing a theatrical work, there's some crossover there, I think, because you're working with image and dialogue and narrative. Yeah, that's fascinating to hear.
Yeah, and as someone who eventually really focused a lot on device theater for many years, I think doing like graphic novels or like visual art with a lot of narrative and text was kind of a gateway into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In some ways. Yeah. There was always like a need, I think, to like generate my own content. And I think I found my way more in device theater and puppetry as I got more comfortable generating my own content, which I think I'm more interested in doing. Than like directing a play with a capital P.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you said in your last year you were getting into directing. What was it about directing that you were attracted to? Like, what was it about it that you were like, oh, I could do this and I could keep pursuing this?
Oh, I think I had wanted to do it for a very long time, and I grew up like imagining plays I wanted to direct, or like I loved getting like musical theater, like album, like CDs of like musicals from the library. And then like imagining like what would happen in between the songs, or like how I would stage certain numbers. So like, I definitely had always wanted to direct, but was just, you know, a recurring challenge is like just being afraid and like learning to get over that fear. So, just to answer your actual question, in undergrad, we would have these auditions at the start of each trimester. And I think I had this idea of like getting all my friends together and like, let's just like do our monologues and give each other feedback, and it won't be so scary if we just like, and we can like help each other. And then I thought I was good at giving feedback. And then I think maybe in hindsight, and I enjoyed that process, but in hindsight, I think maybe I was really good at teaching rather than directing. But I think I had started doing, you know, again, at Lawrence was this very small campus. There was I did a lot of independent studies and student-driven projects, even outside of our main stage season. So I think I had a group of friends and I just wanted to direct this play, and there wasn't space. And we were in this, I found this basement of this like decrepit frat house that wasn't really being used as a frat house. And we like did this like found space piece that I directed in that basement of that house. And then like the next year, we always did this annual production of the Vagina Monologue. So I directed that the next year, which I have no business of directing, but it happened. And then my final year, I directed my senior thesis capstone. I don't even know what we called it. And it was like this adaptation of Medea set in modern day Malibu. And instead of like the choral interludes, we had like these kind of Tori Amos style covers of pop songs commenting on the action. It was semi-disastrous, but it was lovely. And then I think I did two more shows that year. Three friends who were graduating. So I did I directed their senior capstone, which was Nila Butte's The Shape of Things. And then after that, we had one of our main stage shows was always a student produced musical in the Black Box. So I did Cabaret, staged very similar to the 1998 Sam Mendes revival. So like at that time, I was still directing plays, and I was still directing plays kind of how I thought they were supposed to look or how they were supposed to be. So that changed after undergrad, but that was sort of the sort of my interest. And I think I kept on with it because The Shape of Things in Cabaret were so well received. And so I was like, people like really liked it. So I was like, oh, maybe I should do that. And I mean, up until that point, I was really not extraordinary at anything. I was just doing lots of things and just kind of average. And then I was also just running from a lot of trauma that hadn't been processed. So like, it was very easy right out of undergrad to like do a million things. And so I was like, you know, I had a little part-time money job, but it was right at the time of the recession. So there were no jobs. So I had like these little part-time jobs and I was running in between those. And then I would like assistant direct or intern at like the Guthrie or the Jungle or the Children's Theater Company or some equity house. And then I would also like assistant direct at these like smaller independent devised theater companies. And then I just started doing, you know, my own directing. So it was a way of just, I think at that time, just kind of staying busy.
Yeah.
And then it kind of kept, it kept evolving into other opportunities. And I ended up 2 years after that going to an MFA directing program and realizing kind of in the middle of that program, like, oh, I don't know if I'm a director. And I did try to take a leave of absence and I was really encouraged not to. So I stayed on, but decided, I think halfway through the program, like, oh, I don't think this is my path, but I'm going to stay and I'll use this time to figure out what I'm going to do next.
Was there a moment that where that realization crystallized for you, or was it, I'm just curious about how you kind of came to that realization.
Well, I think, you know, again, I was for a while was just, you know, doing plays how they were supposed, or I thought they were supposed to be. And I didn't really know what my own aesthetic was. I was still really new to theater in undergrad in some respects. And so I was just trying lots of things. And I remember as I was finishing up, I had loved, I don't know if your listeners know this company called Theatre de la Jeune Lune. And they were in Minneapolis and they were doing kind of like physical theater adaptations of like Molière or like different operas, or they also created their own original device pieces. And all I wanted to do was intern for them. And they ended up closing down the same month I finished undergrad. And I remember my mentor in undergrad, Annette Thornton, gave me this list of other directors to research. So I think it was like Anne Bogart and Robert Wilson and Richard Foreman and Peter Brook and Mary Zimmerman. And like, she just gave me a list. And I just like, you know, interlibrary loaned everything and like watched every DVD or read every book that had these people's names in it. And then from there, I ended up studying for a month with Anne Bogart and the City Company, like the summer before I started grad school.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, I mean, I have my own complaints about that. I was not totally sold on everything they did. I mean, a lot of people who were studying with them were like treating Anne Bogart's work, like every word that she uttered was like gospel. I was definitely critical of some things that I was learning, but I was like, oh, like it was like a clouds parting moment. Like you could also theater like this. And it was a vocabulary that seemed fairly accessible. And so it was like, well, I already got into this MFA program and I'm fully funded. And so, and I also had been really interested in new plays and I knew there were, you know, a writer's workshop there and it was focused on new play development. And I think I had uttered the word device theater as like a test when I was interviewing for MFA programs. And most, I think every person I interviewed with like rolled their eyes and dismissed it immediately. but at Iowa, they were like, well, we don't really do that. Like that, we don't really do that here, but like, that's one way of working. Like they were completely rolling their eyes.
Iowa nice.
So, yeah. So I'm sorry to answer your question. I'll make this real quick. So I was in the, I was taking all these classes and just kind of bad. And part of that is, I think when you're in undergrad, you know, they just kind of want to open you up to like possibilities. And if you have like the glimmer of some talent, they're really supportive. Whereas in an MFA program, they're really training you to be professional working artists, which is like a very different pedagogical focus. And I was also running from a lot of unprocessed issues and also very self-critical. But I was just feeling very like I was bad at everything. And I just remember being in this Shakespeare class with Alan McVeigh, who was a wonderful teacher and I loved working with and I learned so much from, but just like going to the bathroom and crying. Like I would just felt like I was so bad. I just didn't get it. And I would be in class and he kept saying like, you're so close, you're almost there. Just try your speech again. And I was like, I don't know what I need to be. Like, I just didn't understand. I was just so confused. And then I just kept, you know, directing these plays that were like fine, but they were not, something just wasn't working. Mm. And I think the only consistent ingredient was myself. I'm sure maybe it's just being clouded by my own perception of reality, but I was also just feeling like when I was sneaking off and doing like a devised piece, or I was directing a devised moment within a play, or I started to sneak puppets into a lot of my shows at that time, like that's when I seemed to really be successful. Mm. Or like that's when like it's time, like hours felt like minutes and minutes felt like seconds. Like it just like that's when it felt like magic was happening. Whereas, you know, I was interested in storytelling, but I think the more conventional aspects of theater, I was just not feeling maybe successful at, or it was just like a natural fit for my skill set at that time, I guess. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember in our first year, I think you were directing a piece, right? It was like on top of a bar. We went upstairs to a bar.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the name. I'm having trouble remembering.
It was called Red, A Thing About the Heart.
And
it was
yes, Red, A Thing About
and
the Heart.
And you asked us if we'd ever had our hearts broken.
Yes. So I feel like that was the first play where, before then, right, I was always like, oh, stage, audience, you know, your proscenium, whatever, your black box, whatever. I was like, all through college, that was the type of theaters we've always done, right? Then get to grad school and one of the first shows or something, I think it was that play. And yeah. We're like going up the stairs and this like, I think unsafe like location, like very unstable location. I was like, I think we're going to fall through this floor.
Totally. Yep.
But I remember I was like, that production, it had so much like mood and like mm-hmm. and it was so experiential. Like I was like, I've never experienced play like this. This is like the coolest thing ever. Like I just remember thinking like my understanding just like exploding. Like I was like, oh my gosh, like that was my first like site specific type play and work that I witnessed, and I was like, this is so cool. And I'm like, I just, yeah, that was just like a cool experience. And I feel like now every time I like go to like a site specific type show and I'm like, it didn't have mood like the way David Hansel's did. Like it just didn't have something that I remember. And I'm like, everything, I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to explain, but I just remember like, I think that was like the question of have your heart ever been broken? And we're like in this unsafe location. So...
It was like great. Yeah. That was one of my favorite pieces I've done, totally. Because I think you all met this sort of wanderer figure under a tree and he performed.
Oh, that's like, right.
Each kind of like little cohort of that arrived. And then when everyone was there, I think it was limited to like audiences of 30 or 40 people.
Right. It was very small.
He performed a song and then he led you through downtown Iowa City and there were all these little like planted performances, but there was it was like performance blending into reality, very David Lynch inspired. And then you ended up at the Deadwood Bar and you went up the stairs and I think there had been a tornado through the top floor and it was definitely not safe. that's where I think you were greeted by me and Sarah Johnson, the dramaturg, and Alyssa Perry and Kat Sherman, who co-wrote it and created it with me. And we were costumed. I think we asked you, like, have you ever had your heart broken? And if you said no, we led you to one of the masked figures who, like, performed a speech about their heart being broken. Or if it was yes, which is most of the audience, we led you to that wall where you were given, like, the tea-stained paper and, like, a red crayon, and you wrote your experience, and it was put on that installation. Yeah. I don't know if you remember. Wow. And this was all before the actual performance started.
Yeah, you're saying this, and it's all coming back to me. It was so rich with texture and layers and, like, sensory experience.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. That was a big turning point for me, because that was, I think, at the end of my second year, I was like, what am I even doing here? Even though I loved all the training I had received, and it was so helpful to get me to where I needed to go to next. And, like, Alan McVeigh and Carol McVeigh are, like, two of the best teachers I've ever had in my entire life. So, like, it was a wonderful experience, but it was also helping me realize what I should or should not be doing. And so I think I had that summer in between the second and third year, and we just focused. I had Kat and Alyssa and Sarah and I all happened to be in Iowa City. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I want to make this last year count. And so I was like, I'm only going to do work that I really want to be doing. Mm-hmm. And I'll only do it the way that I want to be doing it. And so that was sort of the first time I, again, let go of my fear and really took that next leap where I really focused on creating what I actually wanted to be doing. So it was a big risk, and I don't know. And, you know, my work has continued to change in the 11 years since then, but that was sort of a big, change or, like, stepping stone for me.
Wow.
And by that point, you were already working with puppets, I think, right? And dolls. And I mean, that has seemed to me to be a really important part of your work. I'm just wondering if you can talk about how you started that kind of work and what is different or differently exciting about working with puppets as opposed to human beings, or in addition to human beings.
Yeah, I mean, I love both. I'll be totally honest about that. I mean, I grew up loving dolls and really projecting so much of myself onto them and projecting myself into objects. So, like, I had this affinity for dolls and objects growing up, and they were kind of also, like, this forbidden object as well. So, like, I was not allowed to have dolls per se, but I had this younger sister, 3 years younger. So my mom would buy dolls for her, and then we would play with them for, like, 4 or 5 hours and have these, like, amazing, like, dramatic, like, afternoon long epic narratives with them. And then my sister was almost like a doll as well, in that I would, like, dress her up as these characters. Wow. And, like, do her makeup and then pose her like a doll and take photographs of her. So, so, I mean, they were always sort of like this really important part of my childhood. And then, what I thought of as puppets growing up, and this is kind of a long story, so please redirect me if this is sort of.
No, we want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
My idea of puppets was like Jim Henson, or like the Muppets, or like Sesame Street. And I could barely even tolerate that Jim felt moving mouth aesthetic. I just, like, hated it, even as a child. I know everybody else loves Jim Henson. It just was not, my jam.
Never heard anyone say felt moving mouth aesthetic. I love that phrase.
Well, those are, like, the two common ingredients. Like, there's a moving mouth and it's felt and it's fuzzy, right? So I hated puppets. And then, again, right out of undergrad, I was just, you know, trying to stay very busy. So I was working all the time and I was seeing everything. And I had a friend who was working in the box office at the Children's Theater Company of Minneapolis, and they were doing Peter Pan, which I loved that story. And I didn't really know what to expect, and I just went to it. And it was done in kind of this, like, story theater style. So it had, like, maybe and this is my memory of it. So I saw it in 2009. So it was quite a while ago. But it was this director from the UK, and it was done in the story theater style with maybe like six people. And they were all wearing kind of like Victorian pajamas. And then when they were like other characters like Mr. Darling or Mrs. Darling, they'd put on like a costume piece. Mm-hmm. And like Peter Pan had a full costume, but all the other characters, it was just kind of like costume pieces. And the set was bare. I think it was just like a big bed on casters. And then when they went to Neverland, they had these huge shadow screens on casters that they rolled in. And then everything in Neverland was shadow puppets.
Wow.
And then they went behind the screens, and Wendy and the two boys and Peter became shadow puppets.
Wow.
Everything in Neverland was shadow puppets. And then there were kind of opportune moments where they would step out from behind the screen and become humans again. So there's that scene that I think was with Peter and Wendy, where she like is like, Peter, we're like the parents of the lost boys, but like, I love you and I want to like make out. I mean, that's not really what's happening, but that's the subtext. And he's like, and then they back under the shadow screen with shadow puppets again. But it was like it was like very choiceful moments. And Fabrizio Montecchi, who is this Italian shadow puppet designer, I believe he designed and staged all those sequences. And so like my brain exploded, and I was like, you know, this visual artist who also really loved storytelling and theater, but was kind of bored by conventional theater. It was like my brain exploded. Like, I didn't even know you could do that. Mm. Like, I had no idea. And I ended up scheduling a meeting with the artistic director of Children's Theater Company, Peter Brocious, and I asked to assist him. And I love that because I love that production. And he was like, well, you know, if you love that kind of theater, you have some experience doing visual art, you should definitely go see Michael Summer's work at Open Eye Figure Theater, Minneapolis. And that season, they had just opened the brick and mortar theater, because I think they had just been kind of, the theater was run by Michael and his partner, Susan Hawes. And I believe they had kind of been traveling, they had opened a brick and mortar theater, even though they had been producing kind of at other venues for a while. So the venue was fairly new, and they did a new piece called Dummy a Display, which was a piece of object puppet theater for adults. They did a revised remount of Elijah's Wake, which was another kind of movement devised puppet work for adults. And then they did the Holiday Pageant, which was a piece for families, which had a lot of puppetry. And it was sort of my first time seeing work where like there was puppets and human performers, and it was for adults, and like design and movement and puppetry and masks and music were like, those ingredients were as important as text. And I just didn't even know that you could do that. And so from there, I just started, you know, I went down a rabbit hole. I just like checked out every book with the word puppet in it from the library. It started this like kind of stalkerish pattern of like cold puppeteers and being like, can we talk on Zoom or the phone, or can we meet in your living room and can I look at your puppets? And I'm naturally kind of shy, but I just it's not like you can. And I started creating my own puppet shows around the time as well, but it's not like you can get an MFA in puppetry, or you can't like, there aren't really in the States like these training programs.
Yeah.
So I found, as I've gotten into, you know, puppet and object driven theater, we're all kind of like the island of lost toys. Like these puppets, because like we don't have these programs really, or like these like comprehensive training programs. So anyway, am I rambling?
No, this is great.
This
is great.
Okay. So I started from there. I remember when I saw the Holiday Pageant at Open Eye Theater, there was a someone who was performing in it, and I saw her name in the program, and her name was Laura Lechner. And I went back to my friend, Emily, who worked at the box office at CTC where I saw Peter Pan. And I said, isn't that your high school friend? And she said, it is. And she hooked us up, and I made my first puppet show with Laura, with Barbie dolls and a carton of milk and blood on the rooftop of a bar like 6 months later. And then I studied at City Company, and then I started my MFA program. And as I was at that MFA program, I just started to sneak puppets and dolls into my shows very slowly. I didn't know what I was doing. Again, there was no official training. I was just picking things up through out of print books and the library and YouTube and stalking these poor puppeteers. And then my last show at Iowa was Half Sick of Shadows, which was like a new play slash device piece. And it was like seven little fairy tales. And they all, it was like the Lady of Shalott locked in her tower. And she couldn't go outside because if she sunlight touched her, she would die. Right. And so she was living in that tower. And she had all these like imaginary little stories she would tell herself. So it was like these little puppet shows she would do for her audience of dolls. There was that stage cover. It was like 100 porcelain dolls over the stage. I don't know if you remember that
show. I remember.
She would do these little puppet shows. There was like seven little puppet shows. And it was like each puppet show was a different style of puppetry. And I did not know what it was. I did not have any idea what I was doing. And I remember it was the last show we did at Iowa. And my final sort of, we had a review every semester. And I remember dear sweet Alan McVeigh saying like, at the end of my final review of grad school, I was like, well, you're a really good teacher. So you should keep teaching theater. You don't really, I don't think you really want to direct plays. And I think you know that.
Wow.
But you could do puppet shows. And I don't know if he, because you just did all these lovely little puppets for this Half Sick of Shadows. And God bless him for just trying to like spin the positive, because I didn't really know what to do next.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of latched onto that. And it was something that I could focus on, when I finished that MFA, because I had nothing to go to from that MFA. Everything I applied to, I was rejected from.
Wow.
And I didn't know what to do next. And so I think I did like 12 applications to like different fellowships, residencies, development programs, training programs. And I think I was rejected from all of them. And I didn't know what to do. And so it was sort of a way to focus myself. And then founded a device theater company with someone from grad school a year later, and the puppets started to just creep more and more into the show. And our last show before the pandemic was a puppet opera, and it was all puppets.
Wow.
Then the pandemic happened. I did not know what to do with, again, did not know what to do with myself. I had been going 200 miles per hour doing device theater and teaching. And also I have a full-time job, and was kind of like, just didn't know what to do with myself. And then all these training programs started to do these wonderful Zoom classes.
So I
had studied with these wonderful teachers in Prague a year after grad school. It's a program called Puppets in Prague, which I loved, where I made a wooden carved marionette. They did a 6-week class that I took. And then the Chicago International Puppet Theater Festival offered a number of classes. And I took at least half a dozen classes through them over Zoom. And then Rough House Theater in Chicago, I think, offered a class, which I took. And I took, I think, one or two more. So I ended up taking like 8 or 9 or 10 classes over the pandemic, and started doing these online puppet slams, which I hated. But there was no, you know, what else could you do? And then I started performing in in-person puppet slams. And then I ended up creating like a full-length marionette show, which I've toured around the Twin Cities Metro the last two summers with my collaborator. And so I think one thing just kind of led to another. And I remember taking a class during the pandemic with Blair Thomas, who's this wonderful puppeteer. Everyone should Google. He's just such a brilliant artist and teacher. And it was in toy theater. So it's another version of paper theater. And it was like another like moment of the clouds parting. And it was like, oh, I can do this. And so if there's any through line to this, like yammering on, it's like, I think for me, my journey has always been like, thinking I'm supposed to do this one thing and then seeing this other thing and learning to give myself permission to do what I really like to do what I'm afraid of. And like that has led me to the next adventure and the next one. And so like, it's just a moment of like clouds continuing to part and me realizing like these limitations are boundless on myself. And I'm setting those restrictions and like, and the need to take those down. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. Yeah.
That's a very long, shaggy dog way of saying, how did you get into Dolls and Puppets? Like,
no, it's great.
12 and a half minutes later.
It's really helpful, I think, for people to hear about that kind of a journey where you're kind of following your instincts, but you're also going where the opportunities are and you're kind of going towards the things yeah. that feel rich and delicious to you. Yeah.
And I think part of it, the reason I yammered on so long is like there isn't a set path.
Right.
You know, it's not like
right.
you get a theater degree and then you get an MFA in puppetry and then there's like a linear path for you. And I would say the same thing for devised theater as well. I think there you kind of have to find your own way, and as you figure it out, you have to keep evolving. You kind of have to keep evolving or you stop working. Mm-hmm. Or you just have to kind of keep forging your own way, and it's scary because there's no set path. But I wouldn't have had it any other way. You know, it's been difficult at times, but it's been ultimately really fulfilling.
Okay, here's a question. So if you have you ever taught a class in puppetry or object theater?
I mean, when I still had my devised theater company, I would always do like workshops to like get the performers ready.
Oh, and cool. Then I did
do like a week, maybe a little less of, I'm doing air quotes for your listeners, master classes mm-hmm. for some undergrad students at University of Colorado Boulder. There's mm-hmm. a mutual friend, Sarah Johnson, who was directing a play by Paula Vogel that had a lot of Boon Rakku inspired puppets in it.
Yeah,
so I did I did maybe 4 or 5 rehearsals where I like trained them and then helped stage or like initially stage some of those moments. I would love to do more teaching. I love teaching.
Yeah.
I've never stopped teaching since grad school. And I love teaching everything from preschool, kindergarten through college and everything in between. So
that's so
another
cool.
big part of my
awesome.
Life.
Yeah.
Well, here's my question. If you had the opportunity to teach a semester long class in like devising with objects or with puppets or directing puppet theater, what would be the assignment you gave your students on the first day?
Ooh, that's a good question.
On the first day.
First day,
like,
wow.
First homework assignment.
Well, I think for me, I'll go back to that first puppet show that I created with Laura Lechner on the rooftop of that bar where we were wearing lingerie and we had like a bunch of Barbie dolls and a carton of milk and some blood, is that I didn't really have I hadn't taken a sculpture class in undergrad. I never sculpted anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taken many classes in sculpture and I've done many deep dives since then and developed that skill over the last 15 years. But that first puppet show was a lot of objects that we sort of reimagined or we threw some glitter on or put some sequins on or whatever. But there, it was mostly objects that we found from like the discount thrift store. But again, working with those objects on a tabletop, all of the ways that you theater works with humans doing, say, kitchen sink realism mm-hmm. has to be thrown out the window.
Right.
Like none of those tools and techniques work at all. And so instead you're on a, you know, I would say, okay, your stage is a tabletop or something that resembles a tabletop. And anything that comes onto the tabletop is some sort of object that you have to animate and reimagine. And I want to see a story with a beginning, middle, end that's carefully, beautifully staged, carefully crafted in 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Go. Something like that. Or another exercise I've done, and this is really simple. This is actually, scratch that. That would be their first homework assignment due a week after the class started.
Mm,
the first assignment we would do in the class is I would have a pile of fabric and paper and newspaper, and I would give them different verbs: fly, float, radiate, mold, and we would focus on animating that in time and space.
Whoa.
And so then, like, take this piece of fabric and animate it with the verb float.
Yes, working on your own for your own personal exploration in your own corner. And I might dim the lights. I might play some music. I might do some more guided improv. And then from there, we might turn the lights back on. I'd put the class in an audience. I'd set up a tabletop and I'd have a pile of sticks. And everyone would get a stick. And then I would put them in pairs of two. And I would say, okay, Sarah and Sam. Sam, you're going to enter first. Your stick is your character. Without using any dialogue. You can use sounds. You can use sounds using your voice to vocalize your character, but no text. You're going to show us who your character is. And then Sarah would enter, and there would be a conflict, a resolution, and an exit.
Ooh. Oh, I want to take this class.
Yeah.
We would do different pairs, and then, you know, once we start to figure out what that is and how you animate a stick and how you create a character through a stick, how you learn to focus your energy, your breath, your voice through a stick, we might have a trio on stage.
Wow.
Or we might add other ingredients. I think getting to those really bare essentials and then adding additional ingredients is sort of I didn't start that way, but that's how I sort of got there through the back door. And that's how I would like to teach it for a beginner.
Oh, so cool.
Do we have the option of recasting the stick if it has no talent?
Oh, you know what I love about puppetry is you don't need any talent. I mean, in the sense that, like, you could never cast me in a play, probably. But I think what is great about puppetry is it's all about what you bring to that object or what you bring to that doll or that puppet. Mm-hmm. And it's really the reason I love it, and I've gravitated it to so much over the years more and more, is that it is like the ultimate outsider art form. Like, if you can imagine it, you can put it on stage. Like, for so long, I was, after having this, like, device theater company, like, for 6 or 7 years after grad school, I was, like, so burnt out of, like, rubbing two dimes together and trying to, like, create these sets out of, like, a $0 budget that looked cool. And, like, on a tabletop stage or in, like, a miniature proscenium, like, if you can draw it, if you can sculpt it, if you can sew it, if you can paint it, you can put it on stage. Like, the impossible can happen. Or even if you can't draw it, you can Xerox it and blow it up and trace it and put it on stage. And so, like, I was just feeling after a while, just feeling like, so theater was great for me in 2008 when my mind was going everywhere and I didn't know how to, like, focus myself. And those restrictions were important. But eventually I was feeling overly restricted and I couldn't put everything I wanted on stage.
Oh.
I don't know if that's sort of why I've continued to sort of be inspired through puppetry.
I have one last question. Let's do one more question before we move on to glistens. So, like, I guess, like, looking at your life, looking at your journey, everything you've been through so thus far and all the experiences on the classes you've taken, and maybe for this interview, like, what's for our listeners out there who are just maybe starting out as a playwright, director, maybe they want to get into puppets and, you know, what advice would you give to those folks?
Oh, I have maybe two pieces of advice. And I think one of them I've already kind of said implicitly, which is, for me, it's like you need to keep evolving or you stop working, for me. Like, I am nowhere where I would have imagined myself being when I finished my undergrad degree in 2008 or my MFA in 2013. I am nowhere where I thought I would be or where I imagined I would be. I am you know, 180 mm-hmm. degrees away from that. But if I had sort of stuck with who I thought I should be or who I was supposed to be, I would have stopped working. So keep evolving, keep stripping away those expectations of who you're supposed to be or who you think you need to be or what kind of artist you are or what kind of art is like legitimate, quote unquote, or like, right. Anyway, that's one thing. And then I think the other is like, what really helped me is I think if you have the opportunity and the privilege to do this, like say yes to everything. I, the 2 years out of the MFA, I said yes to everything. And I did a lot of things I never even imagined myself doing. And I did a number of different kinds of jobs in theater that I never thought I would do. But it kept opening my eyes to what I could do. It sort of just kept leading me. If I said yeah, and again, saying yes to that and giving time for that, it does require some privilege to be able, financial privilege to be able to do that. So I acknowledge that. But I think just saying yes and in that early part of your career, and even later on, now I still say yes to things that seem scary or things that, again, I never would expect to do.
Yeah. I think that's really important. And also it can be, I find myself going through cycles of saying yes to things and then getting overwhelmed and burned out and saying, okay, actually, I need to stop saying yes to so many things for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I say that with like, again, I put the ticking clock at 2 years. So like, I did that for 2 years and then I like promptly burnt myself out. But I'm still seeking out my version of what balance is right now. So like, I just did like two big puppetry pieces this summer. That took me like six, and then now I'm kind of just like doing my regular job and teaching right now, and then I'm getting ready to do something. So I definitely, I'm still advocating for balance and like taking time for your spiritual and physical well-being, for sure. I don't want to like lead your young listeners astray in any way.
No, but I think it is true, and it's really helpful to know that those yeses can lead you somewhere you never thought you could go. It's like the unpredictability of what happens after you say yes to something that can be so valuable.
Yeah, and I remember when I was graduating in 2008, my mentor, who I'm still friends with, I'm still in contact with, Annette Thornton, was like, I asked her for advice, and I was like, you know, Theatre de la Jeune Lune closed down, and I thought I was going to intern with them, and now I'm going to assistant direct for this like equity production of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and I'm like, rolling my eyes about it, and it hasn't even started, and I don't know what to do. And she was like, well, I don't see you following a traditional path. And I was hurt by that. But that's been really my life since then. And I think, again, just open your heart up to that. And like, it's hard to let those initial ideas of yourself or those initial dreams die. But through that death, you can be reborn in other identities or you can find other pathways. When there's a closed door, no one wanted me to direct plays. There was an open window to do these other kinds of things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I said that was my last question, but I have not, this inspired me another question. And I promise this will be the last question before we move on to Glisten. So now to rewind a little bit. So, how do you, David, like, how do you recharge? How do you renew yourself? Like, how do you rest when, you know? Yeah, I think for me, I go like 100 miles per hour. Like, oh, I got to do everything and I got to keep up with it or everything stops, which basically my pregnancy, that's what happened, was like 9 months of like, I just stopped doing everything and anything except eating. Like, I was eating nonstop. But it was just like, how do you, David, how do you recharge and reset?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'm still learning that. I'm still learning how to do that. So I'm a work in progress. And I think I have a habit of going 200 miles. I have a habit, and I definitely did when we knew each other in grad school, of going 200 miles per hour and then burning myself out and just like being like so burnt out. It was that like burned piece of toast that you don't even scrape the black burned bits off. You just like throw up. So I like
delicious part.
It can be delicious, but not always. I'm trying to avoid that. So like really like today, outside of this conversation, like Sundays are really reserved for like cleaning my house, doing my laundry, prepping my meal prep, like getting my life in order and just like having that day just for myself. And trying to eat plant-based as much as possible. Trying to, if I can, exercise, you know, every day, at least go for a walk, go for a jog, get my heart pumping, try to exercise, try to get, again, emphasis on try to sleep 7 or 8 hours a day, 7 or 8 hours every day. Really try to limit my caffeine intake. So I maybe have 2 or 3 cups of tea in the morning and I don't have any caffeine after that. Try to limit my alcohol intake to maybe like a couple drinks twice a week. I drink water constantly. Right now, just because of my schedule, you know, I have a full-time job advising grad students, but then I also had all these wonderful teaching opportunities that fell into my lap for this fall that I just could not say no to. So I'm teaching college students in the evenings, 5 nights a week. And then I also am teaching first graders on Saturdays.
Wow.
So I'm like, I'm going, it's like, I'm kind of going nonstop for this period of September and October. So like, I'm not exercising every day. I'm not sleeping as much as I should. But I am then trying to find moments of keeping a yoga mat in my office and meditating every day. So trying to find moments to like journal and focus in those times of feeling anxiety. And then I also like, I started seeing a therapist during the pandemic and it was like the best thing for me. And I was really afraid of therapy for a long time because I had kind of been forced to see a therapist as a child. And it was just, it was not a good experience for me personally. And so I was just kind of dating around for a therapist. And I found this wonderful, like motherly at brass tacks therapist. And like having those sessions every 2 weeks is like another really great way of just like continuing to remind myself of what I need to maintain my spirit and myself so that I can continue making art and continuing to be a productive, healthy human being. And also continuing to be more and more aware of those, of how my past is informing my present, how, you know, what I need to be a full, fully realized person when I have those bad patterns or cycles that I am falling into again, and how to get out of them, and just being more aware of my actions and what I'm doing. So that's been helpful for me. And I still, I'm like, okay, this September and October, I'm like going 100 miles per hour. So like I have blocked off the month of November and I'm not doing any theater and I'm not doing any puppetry or any teaching. And I need that month just to like recharge.
Yeah.
Very important.
How do you both recharge?
Good question.
Good question. I mean,
right now with a 7 month, it's kind of hard because, but you know, Augie, he's moved to his own room now. And so we're finally trying to like, we finally got some sleep back. So that's big thing is just like, I'm just trying to sleep.
It's so important.
Yeah. And I think, like, after 5, 6 p.m., I clock out. My mind just clocks out. Like, I'm not going to try to think about these things until tomorrow. And I'm just going to veg out and watch TV. Like, I just let myself kind of like after 5 o'clock, after 6 o'clock, after dinner, I'm just not going to text people or like things like that about stuff to do or try not to. I'm like, can you do this? Can you – or here's the grocery list. You got to remember this grocery list. Husband who's sitting right next to me. So stuff like that. But yeah, I think that's something I had to learn for me is creating myself boundaries of
boundaries in your time.
In my time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about you, Sam?
I feel like I'm still really trying to figure that out as a grad student in a PhD program, because I do have a tendency to just do a lot. And right now I'm working on a show, so I'm, you know, like just getting home at 11 every night is really, really taking a toll on me. But the amazing thing about having a dog is that the dog has to be walked every day, and he needs like a good long walk, you know? And so I find it so restorative to go for a walk in the woods or, you know, I live in Boulder, so we have mountains, which is amazing. Just like going for a walk up in on a mountain trail for half an hour or an hour each day really does a lot for me. So,
oh, that's great. Oh yeah. My gosh. Why are you getting home at 11 o'clock? Oh my God. I'm getting home at 3. It's like,
Well, because we have rehearsals from 6 to 10, you know, and then often it's like there's conversations afterwards. Yeah. And then, yeah. It's the kind of the academic theater.
It's difficult. Life. I know.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
I'm doing that for the first time in like 4 years, you know, doing my job and then going to a rehearsal at a college. And it's like, it's so different than, you know, like building a puppet in my studio. I might be doing that at the same time, but I'm still, you know, getting to eat a nice dinner at my house, going for a jog, and then going to the studio, and I don't have to talk to any humans. You know, I can just sculpt or paint.
Right.
But it's like you have to go to that. You have to leave your house, drive in rush hour. You're in the room for 4 hours. You have a conversation afterward with your stage manager, and then you're getting home at 11. It's like, how is this my life before? Yeah, for 15 years, how did I do this? Oh my gosh. So I'm going
to. I know. And I'm pretty lucky that I can like go home during the day and stuff. But some of my students, yeah, I don't know how they do it, because some of them are on campus, you know, from like 9 in the morning until 10 at night or whatever.
Well, I'm going to take your advice. Really, I don't have a woods on campus during the day, but I'm going to go for a 30-minute walk. Come help.
Oh my gosh, makes a big difference. Yeah, just getting, for me, getting outside and getting sunlight on my skin and being around trees or grass or, you know, something that is not built by human beings.
That forest bathing, that's a thing.
Really, it's like medicine for me. Forest bathing,
it's good for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, shall we move to Glistens?
So this is part of our show where we talk about what struck us this week, inspired by the workshop. I don't know if you remember, David, that's something that Dare would say, like, what's a glisten?
I totally remember.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I remember like it was yesterday, so yes, but I'm all ready.
All right, so I'll start first. My glisten is I've been listening to nonstop of Olivia Rodrigo's new album, Guts. It is freaking good. I just can't stop listening to it. It's like she just pulled everything that I love in like the music from is like there's like a little bit of grunge, there's a little bit of like pop, there's a little bit of like just everything. And I'm just like, how is this person, like I feel like she's like an old soul or something. Like her lyrics are so funny and catchy, and she's a good writer. And I was like, this is a really good album. And I think so I feel like Taylor Swift album Midnights and this album is going to be like top competition for the best album of the year for pop. I think so. It's going to be tough. That's my two cents. All right.
I only know Driver's License.
Oh, this is a new one. This came out. This is our new album this year. Yeah.
Okay. I got to listen to it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's good. Okay. Sam?
My question is I have been reading all these climate change plays, so very much welcome suggestions. And I just read this play by a Canadian playwright named Matthew McKenzie. It's called Bears, and it is about a man who has to leave his job at a pipeline company in a hurry. You don't quite know why at the beginning of the play. And he walks across Western Canada and slowly transforms into a bear. A grizzly bear. It's really, really cool. And it's one of the few climate change plays I've read that, you know, I think it's important sometimes to kick people in the stomach and say, wake up, you know, things are terrible. But this play feels so joyful and fresh and alive. And, you know, it doesn't sugarcoat the damage that we are doing, but it makes me feel energized. So, yeah, I really recommend it. Bears by Matthew McKenzie.
Okay. I want to check that out.
Yeah. It has this chorus. So it's this one guy playing this guy, Floyd, who's the one who turns into a bear. And then there's a chorus that transform into bighorn sheep and chickadees and, oh gosh, like wildflowers and all these other creatures that he encounters on his journey. It's really
is this
beautiful.
Like a one-act play or is it full length?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's pretty short. I read it. I found it. I didn't know about it. And I found the book on a table of Canadian plays at a conference I was at. And it's like maybe 37 pages. Because there's so much dance and movement, I think it could, the range of minutes it could take on stage could really vary.
So is the text like poetic or what's the style of text?
Yeah. It is. It feels very poetic. It's one thing that's interesting is the character playing or the actor playing Floyd, who's the guy, talks about himself in the third person. So there's this interesting kind of distancing effect as he's observing the changes that are happening to his body. And so it feels... Yeah, it feels kind of poetic. It also feels like it doesn't feel ethereal poetic. It feels very embodied and like grounded, but yeah, non-naturalistic. And funny. It's also quite funny.
And this is published in like an anthology?
Yes. It's a standalone book by a Canadian press. I bet
I'll Google it later. I would love to read it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good. What's your glisten, David?
My glisten is, you know, I was talking to an old friend who is an actress, and she had just written her first novel, and she had recommended this book called Saves the Cat to me. And there's like a playwriting, Ooh. Screenwriting version and a novel version, and I read both of them, and it's like how to structure your story in like the classic three-act structure. And I had read other books like this, like The Writer's Journey or Story, and they hadn't resonated. And I, again, I like read it, and I don't know if it's like the particular book or where I am in my own journey, but it was like another clouds parting moment. And while I was reading this, Spotify recommended this podcast called Once Upon a Disney. And I'm starting to come out I'm slowly coming out as a Disney gay, but this podcast.
I feel like I knew that already.
You did? I don't know.
Maybe I just saw it.
I thought I was more successfully hiding it before, but I'm open about it now. But it's a podcast looking at each episode is looking at a classic Disney movie from the 20th century. Looking at all of the sort of structural things and sort of a classic three-act screenplay structure and looking at like kind of traditional screenwriting and like character arcs. And it's like blowing my mind. And like sometimes like a movie, and it's so funny. Like the co-hosts are Larry Brenner and Andy Redwine, and it's so funny. And they will just like... some of the episodes, like you'll sort of unpack, like, well, the movie thinks this is the protagonist, but if you really look at sort of what character has the most arc, it's actually this one. And like just looking at structure, which again, character development and structure have never been my strong suits. And so I don't know if it's sort of this podcast or this book or where I am, but it's like my brain is exploding. So highly recommend.
Well, except for the character development of a stick.
Yeah. I mean, like maybe conventional human characters in a well-made three-act structure is maybe not my natural inclination. Yeah. And it's like brain is exploding in a good way.
Yeah, I feel like Disney.
Cool. What's it called again?
What's it called?
What? It's called Once Upon a Disney.
Okay.
Hosted by Larry Brenner and Andy Redwine, and it's on Spotify.
It's on Spotify. Yeah, I was just going to say that I feel like Disney movies are so great looking at story because I think from what I heard is that, you know, the animators are like, or the directors, they spend so much time on story because animation takes so long or like it's so hard. So it's like they have to get the story down or it's like they, you know, it becomes expensive to try to redo it or like, but yeah, they spend so much time on story. So it's like so good to watch Disney movies, follow story. I watched Pinocchio, the original one. Long time ago and I was like it's so crazy how much animation has changed and I'm like watching it I'm like it's like watching a picture book, you know, I'm like this is I can't believe it, like that this was animation and people thought this was like it's just so much has changed. But yeah, I'm sidetracking.
I love old animation.
Yeah, I love that sort of hand-drawn animation.
Yeah,
there's something about it, even though it is very, it looks so different now. Anything that's sort of those handmade worlds, I just feel so drawn to. So, yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, David, it's been such a joy to get to talk to you. If our listeners are curious, where can they find out about you and your work?
Well, I still have like a web portfolio online and it's David Hansel Theater. So Hansel is H-A-N-Z as in zebra, A as in apple, L as in Larry, theater with an R-E because I'm old school. So it's davidhanseltheater.carbonmade.com. I'm not paying the extra $100 to have the Carbonmade removed from that title. So they can see my work there. Otherwise, I'm on Instagram. I'm lavender_scented_nostalgia.
That's so good. I'm so curious what inspired that.
Amazing.
There is an author that I love. She did The Rose and the Beast. I don't know if you've read that book. Francesca Leah Block. She's an author that Kat Sherman is a
I loved her.
Yeah, she's a writer that Kat Sherman, who was a playwright at Iowa with us, she loved and she gave me that book when we were in grad school. And then from there, she had I read the whole series in like literally 2 days. It was called Wheatsy Bat, the Wheatsy Bat series.
Yeah.
It's like totally, I mean, I was reading this as like a 28-year-old, but it's for like 13-year-old girls. But I loved it. And it's like set in this kind of fairy tale, magical realist LA landscape. And it's just like, teenage girl having these like kind of like magical adventures with her like gay best friend and they're like eating like all this magical food and it's wonderful. So there's all this sort of evocative poetic language even though it's like a preteen chapter book, and I think one of the phrases I underlined in the book was lavender scented nostalgia, and that really describes the feeling of those books.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah.
So that's like my second glisten unintentionally.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.